coming to take what's theirs, until one side or the other meets their fate right there in the hog yard. Is he just blowing? V said. He means it, ma'am, Delray said. And two good marksmen firing from cover with Henry rifles can take down a right smart of men fast. So I don't fully doubt the story he told. I said to him that we had no intention of robbing him or burning him out. Said we were traveling with a lady and children and they were hungry. The farmer said he didn't believe ladies existed in the world anymore. Or God either. But he said if we could produce one or the other of them at his fortress and prove him wrong, he'd give us an entire smoked ham and send us on our way with his blessing. A ham? V said. Yes. And you could smell the smokehouse from where we stood talking, like cooking bacon in a greasy skillet over a campfire. But that man's about crazy, and I don't believe we need a ham bad enough to deal with him. V looked around at the children, at Ellen, and the thin Navy boys still traveling along. How sickly they looked. She said, Delray, I believe you lack confidence in our evidence. Ma'am, proof that ladies have not gone extinct. No, ma'am, not at all, but I will say that Richmond's a long way back, and we've all been living rough for a while now. Of course, this is Georgia, and who knows what standards they go by. Delray, is there a state with standards you know and approve? Not any I've been to. I do take your point about rough traveling, though. Give me 20 minutes to clean up and change clothes and trowel on a great deal of powder, and then you and I will take the ambulance and go out to this fortress and give it a try. The Navy boys should follow along with us. An entire smoked ham and those beautiful greens you found would be a feast for all of us, and plenty of ham biscuits later. Model coonhounds bawled at their approach with such force that V worried they would rupture a lung. But the nearer she got, the more they backed away from the horses and hung near the porch, ready to retreat into the dark underneath. She pushed the palm of her hand toward them and said, "Bad dogs." The dogs walked, angling away, looking at her side-eyed. She said, "Good dogs." They came forward with their tails wagging. V said to Delray, just introduce me, and then, after that, let me do all the talking. Do not use my real name. Delray nodded. V looked at the boys. What? Ryland said. Simple, V said. Don't say my name. I'll do the talking, yes? We've got it, Bristol said. Ryland said, but what name should we call you? Just keep your mouth shut, Delray said. The man and his son, a boy even younger than the Navy boys, but looking completely dead-eyed, came out the door with their Henry rifles cocked and angled down over their forearms, ready to lift and fire, but being polite about it. Beyond the doorframe and through the front windows, V saw women passing behind the two men, their much-washed homespun dresses ghostly in the brown light of the house, their drained faces and dark eyes glancing outward toward a larger world full of threat. The man said, "What's all this, then?" "Sir," Delray said, "I would like to introduce Mrs. Anthony Thomas, the lady I mentioned earlier. However, I don't know your name to make a proper introduction." The boy took his eyes off V and Delray and twitched his attention toward his father for half a second and then right back at them. The father said, "My name is Mr. Wiggins." Delray said, "Mrs. Thomas, permit me to introduce Mr. Wiggins." "Ma'am," Wiggins said. He wore no hat to lift, and sort of dipped his head toward her an inch, a vestigial bow. V said, "Mr. Wiggins, I believe you know of our circumstances, and I didn't want you to trouble yourself with our difficulties. We all have more than enough responsibility in taking care of our own families." "Amen," the boy said. The father let his rifle down and stood its butt against the porch boards. The boy, though, kept alert. There was a good deal of killer about him, and it was why he still lived. The last 4 years had made a whole generation of young boys who ought to have been going to school and learning a trade and thrilling deep in their bones just to dance with a girl and peck her on the cheek, into slit-eyed killers with no more tell of emotion than an old riverboat faro gambler. V climbed down from the ambulance bench and walked toward the porch. She said, "Could I possibly speak a word or two with the lady of the house?"
"With who?" Wiggins said.
"Your wife, a word, please."
"What purpose?"
"Politeness. What but manners do we have left?" Wiggins looked at the boy, but the boy just kept flicking his attention between V and Delray and Bristol and Rylan. He held his rifle balanced, scale-like in his hands, measuring its weight to be ready to lift it fast and fire. Wiggins said,
"Minute, please, Miss Thomas."
He went to the door and spoke something inside, and a slim woman walked out and down the steps. She wore a cotton dress, laundered almost thin as gauze. The fabric might have been a sort of milky chocolate at one time, patterned with leaves or flowers. Now it looked like parchment marked with script too faint to read. She carried a heavy black pistol, and she looked young to be mother to 5. Pretty in an exhausted way. Much as V imagined herself to look, having birthed one more than Mrs. Wiggins, and really, the dead ones batter you even more than the living, pull more out of you in their leaving than their arriving. When they were close enough to speak softly, V said, "Mrs. Wiggins, are you and your daughters all right?" Mrs. Wiggins lifted her left hand and wiped the prominent second knuckle of the forefinger 3 swipes against the wings of her nose, and then swept her loose and mostly brown hair back from her forehead with the inside angle of her elbow. "All right," she said. "If we're not, where could we go to be right? And what would we live on when we got there? Just breathe air and be fine? I'm not standing here to be judged by you or anybody else. I only meant God hates lies, and I'm not going to tell one to you. We're not any of us all right. We're all about half crazy since the raiders started passing through. Wiggins and I didn't carry slaves, didn't believe in them, and didn't want them. Believed there would be a bloody reckoning for them, and we were right. We hoed our own rows, emptied our own night jars, cooked our own meals, taught our children to read, and when we could spare the money, we bought them books too hard for us to read. Our goal was simple. If every generation helps the next take one step up, imagine where we might all be someday. But those boys from the Northern Army came after us anyway. 6, or a dozen at a time in waves, for weeks. Trying to take what they could carry and burn the rest. If we had a choice but to let them kill us or to put them down, I can't see it. Every one of us killed at least a person, and 2 of the girls can't lift the blame off themselves. They dream about it no matter how I tell them the loads on those boy soldiers for their own dying. And on the old men who sent them here. You turn the other cheek too many times in this world, and before you can blink, you're wiped away. We didn't go out to steal everything they had and burn their farms to ashes. They came here, and they stayed here. I'm sorry they believed whatever they believed about us that made it right to come try to kill us. There are 31 of them. They don't have markers. But we all went out in the pines to put them in the ground and say sad words over them about their delusions. The pistol hung from her hand, pulling her down, a burden heavier than she could bear. The other women, all in their teens, hovered behind the front door and the flanking windows, watching. V pictured dark woods, a crescent moon riding across a deep indigo sky, a dark night procession of pretty girls and tall dogs lit by yellow pine knot torches, tangled bodies of bloody young men heaped in a wagon bed. V said, "Could I come inside and meet your girls?" They were indeed pretty and strange, and might have fallen from Venus for all they knew of the current outside world. They lined up to meet V, a receiving line. They were all the same size, and V imagined a common pile of worn and faded dresses from before the war, every morning each girl just drawing something from the pile without thought of possession or personal style. They had names along the lines of flowering plants and tragic heroines, names like Daisy and Daphne and Laurel and Hecuba, though V couldn't keep any of them straight. The girls flurried around preparing an afternoon tea, carrying their pistols and then setting them down on every horizontal surface in a percussive four-beat rhythm. The tea was herbal, a sinus-clearing mixture that made a nice greenish-yellow cup. One of the girls set out a platter of cold breakfast biscuits cut into triangles and drizzled with honey and sprinkled with some brown spice similar to cinnamon but more piney. By way of transition, V pulled her pistol out of her reticule. It rested in her hand so small and inconsequential compared to their heavy Colt's army revolvers. V's lay there, unthreatening, prettier than it needed to be for its function. And two, at least while in her possession, it had killed no one. Hard to reconcile these lovely girls with Mrs. Wiggins's statement that everyone in the family had killed at least one human being. "This is a gift from my husband," V said. "He meant me to kill myself with it if I found myself on the brink of being dishonored." They all looked at the little thing, and then one of the girls said, "Did he understand how a gun works? Somebody comes at you, you point it at them, not yourself." "Well," V said, "I always planned on using it your way, no matter what his intentions were." They sipped tea a moment, and then V said, "I understand this has been a hard time." The girl, who looked oldest, meaning maybe 17, said, "They didn't come marching across Georgia as one big army all together. They fanned out 60 or 100 miles wide in little bunches of raiders. Sometimes only a few men, but one time more than a dozen. And then thieves and scavengers followed them. First bunch, 4 of them. It was clear you let them do what they wanted and take what they wanted, or they would burn you out and leave you wandering the roads. Say one thing they didn't like, they might go wild and slaughter everybody. But Billy reached real fast and yanked away one of their Henry rifles and started working it. 6 seconds later, we were all standing around in a cloud of gun smoke trying to catch our breaths, watching those soldiers finish dying. After that, there wasn't any luck to it," one of the younger girls said. "We had a plan. Of course, if there had ever been 30 of them at one time, or if just one got away to tell what happened to the rest, we wouldn't be sitting here talking." "They made us choose," the older girl said. "Them or us." The youngest girl, very pale, her hair loose below her shoulders, said, "Yes, that's the choice we made. Us." One of the girls poured more of the herb tea, and V looked around the dim parlor. Heart pine floors, and pine wainscoting, and pine plank ceilings. Yet it displayed flares of decor. Many wide, dark picture frames surrounded small watercolors, each one composed of three horizontal bands of color grading up from beige to green to blue, representing the only landscape they knew. Bits of needlework, antimacassars, and tabletop doilies in patterns like overlapped leaves or explosions of flower petals, or diagrams of mental geometry representing the physics of existence way into the depths of the night sky. 3 dozen precious, well-read leather books stood on a shelf over the fireplace. Milton and Shakespeare, Dickens and Trollope and Scott, and translations of random Greeks and Romans, and one volume which, when V pulled it off the shelf, turned out to be actual Greek, a collection of lyric poets. By way of trying to prove the non-extinction of ladies, she translated a few lines on the fly. The girls crowded around. Very slowly, pointing word by word, V read, "The moon sets. Then the Pleiades. Midnight. Time goes away. I am alone." When she closed the book, they all applauded, as if she had just performed an amazing magic trick in reverse, starting with a sawed-in half-lady and putting her back together. They all talked at once, asking how she knew the code to reading that strange book of runes. Their voices rose like a bird chorus floating lovely in V's mind, without every note needing to carry a specific definition. She told them about Winchester, how much he taught her for no reason but his devotion to learning, and for no compensation but her eternal love. It would have been easy to dismiss their efforts toward culture as laughable, crude similitudes and dislocations, proximate at best. But where did the Greeks start? With fundamentals, sheep and olives and grapes, white stones and dark blue sea. The moon and planets in the night sky and willing spirits, which these girls had aplenty. Smart, pretty girls with guns. V was as touched as they were by such welcome company. Their yearning she recognized fully from that age, the need to become something, at least within the vicinity of your dream of yourself. She looked at that quartet of lifted faces and wished each of them something better than the man they would most probably find themselves bound to till death, even if that something better was solitude. She shaped a ragged philosophy to tide them through lonesome nights. It was simple, and not one she'd ever found the strength to follow. The idea was, the you are with others is not you. To be lonesome is to be who you most fully are. And also, maybe something about the great reluctance with which we let go of our belief in a just God. When she finished talking, she feared she had said too many of those things aloud, or all of those things and more. The girls looked at her in some confusion, but excited and willing to consider and discuss the merits of her comments. V looked at Mrs. Wiggins to gauge her reaction, and Mrs. Wiggins reached and touched her hand very briefly in reassurance. So the girls and V talked on and on. Despite being unable to keep their names straight, V fell in love with them all and wanted to take them with her, load them and their weapons into the wagons, and have conversations around campfires every night until late, as they made their way deep into the jungles of Terra Florida and through the horrors of its reptiles and outlaw inhabitants, and across the Straits of Florida to safety in old civilized Havana. But then came the immediate recognition that whatever V's best intentions, these girls were safer here, smothered under dim pine woods inside their hog fortress, than coming along with her to talk about poetry and beauty, while big dollar bounties hovered like a vortex of buzzards overhead. V's contribution to their lives would likely be to drag them down darker than they already were. A sorry realization when you know the best you can offer is not your presence, but your absence. Eventually, V and the Wiggins girls all walked out of the house as a babbling group, talking over the top of each other about books they all intended to read and how much they loved each other. V promised that if she ever retrieved her library from Mississippi, she would send them boxes and boxes of books. They spent a great deal of time kissing cheeks and hugging and saying bye, including Mrs. Wiggins. V pulled her aside and kissed her and said, "You know these girls of yours are splendid." Mrs. Wiggins said, "I've been knowing it since they were old enough to stand up on their feet and talk for themselves." Mr. Wiggins had a bundle, a big awkward lump inside a greasy swaddling of hemp tow. A joint of yellowish bone stuck out the top in place of a handle. He said, "There's a ham and a couple slabs of bacon to boot. So, you've reached a favorable judgment as to the existence of ladies," V said. "Ladies, maybe. I've been listening at the window. But God's still a great mystery." "Yes," V said. "Mystery is his primary attribute. But the pork is more than generous." "Makes me happy to see my girls happy," Wiggins said. Delray gave V a hand into the ambulance and the Navy boys mounted up, and away they all went. Still, the Wiggins boys stood on the porch watching intensely, his Henrys balanced and ready to lift and fire. At the first bend in the road, Delray said, "So that's the way ladies do?" "Good Lord, no," V said. "Not in the least." They rode back to camp in silence, and V thought about how the landscape would never be the same after this war, even if the blasted battlegrounds healed with new green growth and burned farms were either rebuilt or allowed to rot into the dirt. The old land had become all overlain with new maps of failures and sins, troop movements, battles and skirmishes, places of victory and defeat, and loss and despair. Slave quarters, whipping posts, and slave market platforms. Routes of attack and retreat. Monumental cemeteries of white crosses stretching in rows to the horizon. And also lonesome mountain burials, with one name knife cut into a pine board, weathering blank in 10 years and rotted into the ground in 20. The land itself defaced and haunted with countless places where blood, all red, whoever it sprang from, would keep seeping up for generations to come. That place out in the pine woods would haunt those girls to death and keep haunting. The last one, the youngest, at 100 years old, tiny and translucent, might tell the story of the marauding army and the killings and the torchlight burials to a little girl in 1950, who would carry it with her into the 21st century. Subtract everything inessential from America and what's left. Geography and political philosophy, V says. The Declaration and Constitution. The Federalist Papers. I'd say geography and mythology, James says. Our legends. He gives examples. Talks about Columbus sailing past the edge of the world, John Smith at Jamestown and Puritans at Plymouth Rock, conquering the howling wilderness, Benjamin Franklin going from rags to riches with the help of a little slave trading, Frederick Douglass escaping to freedom, the assassination of Lincoln, annexing the West. all those stories that tell us who we are. Stories of exploration, freedom, slavery, and always violence. We keep clutching those things, or at least worn-out images of them, like idols we can't quit worshiping. Taking the life of a nation is a serious task, V says. Few succeed, even if the cause is just. We didn't, and ours wasn't. But sometimes I can't help missing those days when we all just took care of each other. We? James asks. Everyone living together at Briarfield in the hurricane. If you mean slaves, you only remember what they allowed you to remember. Even if Davis Bend was really as humane as you believe, they kept their misery to themselves. Kept it a mystery to you. I promise that's true. Think of it as a great gift, a mark of affection, the protection of your memory. Let's don't start getting ironic with each other. It's true. V stands and says, "A moment. Please don't go." She walks down the steps from the terrace to a path leading into a flower garden. She's gone for 15 minutes, and in that time, an employee of the retreat comes out from the lobby and asks how he might be of help, a certain tone to the question. When V returns, she tells about the political fighting in Washington during the whole decade of the 50s, how the struggle over slavery became more and more poisonous, even though a possible model stared the lawmakers on both sides square in the face. Some of the northern states, Pennsylvania and Connecticut, had just recently finished the gradual abolition of slavery. Others, New Jersey and New Hampshire, were still in the process and remained so until the Emancipation Proclamation. But they all worked on similar plans, ending slavery bloodlessly over time. Of course, all the northern states, including those still holding slaves through the 50s and on into the 60s, claimed high ground. V says, their moral position in converting from slaveholders to champions of freedom was about like a house cat on a cold night scooting through a closing door just before the latch clacks shut. But sometimes, timing is all. A brief moment of history, less than a deep breath, becomes the difference between inside and outside. In Richmond, people attacked V on the grounds that her greatest ambition had been to become First Lady of the United States of America, which she couldn't deny. She wanted to live at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue for 8 years and throw fine dinners for the smartest and most entertaining people in the world. And having that dream come real was right at the tips of her fingers. When your lowly congressman husband becomes a great wounded American war hero in Mexico, widely known for his genius battlefield strategy and personal risk and sacrifice, and then he becomes a U.S. Senator and Secretary of War, well, living in the real White House someday is hardly a delusional aspiration. Though, at the time Jeff became Secretary of War for the United States, one of his old teachers at West Point wrote, "Neither Davis nor my opinion of him have changed since I knew him as a cadet. If I am not deceived, he intends to leave his mark in the Army and also at West Point, and a black mark it will be, I fear. He is a recreant and unnatural son, would have pleasure in giving his alma mater a kick, and would disclaim her if he could." Those days in Washington, she dreamed nothing but black doom. She saw the end from the beginning. All the loss and devastation. Our beautiful country full of ghosts haunting cornfields and cow pastures and nightwoods for centuries to come. She told Mary Chestnut that the way it would all play out was that the southern states would secede and cobble together a breakaway country and would make Jeff its president, and it would all fail disastrously. For a stretch of weeks in 1855, she dreamed in detail about being First Lady. But the White House was all wrong. She'd been all over it during the past 15 years, not just the public rooms, but also every hallway and bedroom upstairs. In her dream, though, she wandered, lost, looking for an exit. Whatever path she took, through hallways, up and down stairways, she always wound around to find herself in a dim downstairs kitchen with the servants. Eventually, she did live as First Lady, but in a White House reflected in a grotesque carnival mirror, though downstairs, she recognized the kitchen, that dead end her dream kept leading her toward. Second half of the 50s, when government failed to do anything but shove the country into convulsion and apocalypse, Jeff's health declined. His malaria kept recurring, and his bad eye dimmed slowly, almost to blindness. V spent much of that time having children. Messages in bottles floated out into a terrifying future. Samuel was the first, a fat and happy baby. Everything struck him as funny. V's First Lady friend, Jane Pierce, the madwoman allegedly confined in the attic of the White House, loved taking Samuel on long carriage rides all around town and out in the country. She loved his company, his entertainment, his belly laugh that seemed far too big to come from such a small package. Samuel fell ill and died when he was still 3, and for months afterward, V closed herself up in their big rented house. Jeff kept working, going to the Capitol every morning, but he couldn't sleep and sometimes wandered the streets of Washington late at night. Friends and family offered brief sympathy, but infant death rates stood so high that many people didn't really think of them as fully human those first few years. Case in point, V's father. Samuel had been gone only a month or 6 weeks when WB sent her a breezy note barely acknowledging her loss. He might have mentioned hearing she was under the weather. She tossed it in the fire and wrote back that she would let him know when she recovered from her grief. But until then, his mercantile messages weren't welcome. She used the word a lot around that time, mercantile, to mean without emotion, businesslike. Jeff finally had to request that for the good of their marriage, she stop using that word in regard to his family. Maggie and Jeffy and Joe and Billy arrived at roughly 2-year intervals. Little bursts of life during dark days for the country, when the arguments over slavery turned fatal for hundreds of thousands. She was pregnant with Billy when things fell apart completely, those frightening and chaotic days as state after state seceded, and the southern legislators resigned and packed up and went home to improvise a rebel country. Toward the end, an English journalist reporting on the Senate described Jeff as having the face of a corpse, the form of a skeleton. Jeff held on, the last of the last, hoping newly elected Lincoln and the Yankee Congress would take a deep breath and try to find a way to avoid war. But that didn't happen. Lincoln came to town refusing to talk to anybody who disagreed with him. Jeff stayed on, hoping to be imprisoned, since the North had vowed to arrest for treason any member of the House or Senate from secessionist states who tried to leave. All the others, even Judah, eased out of town. But Jeff always wanted a trial, to wrap himself in the Constitution and defend himself in front of the Supreme Court, either win or go down a martyr, wife and children be damned. Except the Federals weren't really enthusiastic about charging anyone with treason, given that the Constitution wasn't clear about what to do if members of the Club of States wanted to resign, whether to let them go or try to kill them. So Jeff and V went home to Briarfield, a dreary trip because V sensed the tidal wave rising to break over them. Jeff became more silent than usual, brooding over the unwelcome likelihood that he would become president, at least until an election could be organized. Neither of them felt surprised, therefore, when one afternoon a man came riding up at Briarfield, his horse in a lather, and gave Jeff the message. He had been appointed president of a country that didn't exist. Nevertheless, they both read the letter with faces grim, as if it were a death notice. Nor was V surprised when the attack on Sumter soon began brewing. their friend Robert Toombs, until recently a U.S. senator from Washington, Georgia, sent Jeff a letter of warning against being pulled into battle. Toombs wrote, "It is suicide, murder, and will lose us every friend at the North. You will wantonly strike a hornet's nest which extends from mountain to ocean, and legions now quiet will swarm out and sting us to death. It is unnecessary. It puts us in the wrong. It is fatal." Ultimately, Jeff, who had read nearly as much history as V, refused to see that days of building and maintaining fortunes based on enslavement were passing quickly. Country after country had been finding various ways to end the ownership of people. Haiti, Bolivia, Chile, Mexico, Venezuela, and Peru saw the writing on the wall. Jeff and his wealthy and powerful friends couldn't.
Scaffold, February 1862. Out the window, a low sky and drizzle, everything gray. February cold radiated through the glass. Even in cobbled streets, mud swelled between stones and smeared into horse shit and the general everyday effluent to make a gray organic paste, slick and greasy and shoe-heel deep, shiny even in the absence of sunlight. V raised the window sash a few inches and reached her hand into the morning and found the day as raw to her palm as it appeared, the air fragrant as an outhouse. She turned straight from the window to her medicine. Her new doctor had suggested, as if it were a brilliant discovery, that when she felt low, cored out, she should take a glass of wine and a pinch of morphine. Same prescription as when she'd miscarried, and also when Samuel died. The current new baby, Billy, lived and existed as a real being in the world, sleeping and eating and crying and filling diapers to his armpits. But every moment, her insides pulled at her, much like with the lost children, a feeling of absence, a suction. She unfolded the wax paper packet and tapped some of its powder into a generously sized wine glass, and then poured Bordeaux near the brim. Just enough room to stir with her finger until the lumps dissolved, and then put her finger in her mouth, so as not to lose a grain. 15 minutes after, still feeling desperately empty, she poured another glass and the remainder of the packet. She put on a robe and walked downstairs to the kitchen, moving like fog from room to room, down 2 flights of stairs and along hallways, so drifting in her thoughts that she kept touching walls with fingertips to confirm reality. In the kitchen, Mary Amelia and Ellen worked with their housemaids and undercooks preparing for the party that evening. Mary ran the place as head housekeeper, and Ellen was the main cook. V was still fairly new to the house and to both of them. "Coffee," V said, standing in the doorway, a hand on the casing. Mary Amelia was a broad-faced Irish widow of a ship captain, maybe a year or two younger than V, pretty and tough and weary. She'd been trapped in the South after borders shut down following Sumter. All her American family lived in Baltimore, and she let everyone know she couldn't wait for the war to end one way or the other so she could go home and be with her children. Mary said, "Ma'am, I know you're new here. We all are. But the way it works is you pull the cord and ring the bell, and I send someone right up to see what you want done. And then we do it. So go back upstairs and let's practice." V looked at Ellen, and Ellen smiled and shrugged her shoulders. "Problem is, I'm here now," V said. "Cup or mug?" Ellen said. "Mug, please." Ellen poured and then walked V back to the third floor. Ellen was a slim, serious young woman who looked about an equal mixture of white and black and wore her hair pulled tight to her head, parted down the middle. She set V's mug down and said, "I'd tell you Mrs. Amelia's bark is worse than her bite, except pretty often she bites too." Half an hour before showtime, V and Jeff emerged from the front door of the gray house. With Jeff's upturned hand cupping her elbow, they drifted with the rain across the sidewalk and into the carriage, a wave of perfect black and white fabric, and a dark violet sheen in V's skirts. Jeff gripped his inaugural speech tight under his right arm inside a leather folder, written in V's blue hand, which Jeff read more easily than his own because she silently acknowledged his diminished eyesight and wrote extra large. Settled in the carriage, Jeff tapped her wrist, the intimate coin-size exposure of flesh where the glove hooked and blue veins pulsed, a touch of fingertip subtle and intimate as a Masonic handshake. He looked straight ahead. She turned her palm up and gripped his hand, feeling the bones beneath the skin, all knuckle and joint, a tiny bundle of kindling. She said, "You can make a bad speech sound good." An escort of footmen, six black men meant to walk alongside the carriage, began forming up. Two ahead of the front wheels, two behind the back wheels, two by the doors. They dressed as pallbearers, mourning clothes, black suits, black vests, black top hats banded with black satin. One man even wore a hank of limp black veil trailing like a horsetail from his hat band down past the collar of his coat. They might as well have fixed black dyed ostrich plumes from the brow bands of the horse bridles. V sat observing the scene through her side window. A few colors, highly saturated, dazzled in the gray morning. Teeth in the pallbearers' mouths, white and yellow, seemed exaggerated as colors of cake icing. Missing teeth, deep black. One pallbearer's cravat, a bluebird splash at his neck. Everything else rendered in shades of black and gray like a photograph. Mud wetted the backs of their pant cuffs. The black of the mourning bands around their hats blacker than a moonless night sky. Blacker than a 100-year-old mojo hand. Blacker than the bottom of a Welsh coal pit. Blacker than the iris of the devil's right eye. A black with its own draw. A puckered suction pulling down. V stepped out of the carriage and went to Jeff's new secretary, Burton Harrison, and said, "Who would be responsible for the costumes?" "Ma'am?" "The men alongside. The choice of their attire." "I'd have to ask," Burton said. "Well, if you don't know, who does?" "They would know, ma'am. The men. I could ask them." "No, don't start troubling yourself." V stepped to one of the men, the one who seemed like the leader, dignified, proud, his posture perfect. A shiny black silk band clasped his outside upper arm. V said, "You are all dressed so handsomely. Who chose your wardrobe?" The man looked at her, his eyes sliding by her face, pausing only half a second, but seeing what he needed to see. "Show respect. Same way we do a burying round here, ma'am." V let that roll over her. And then she decided to ease back without interference. Let suitable equipage for living in a dying world pass without further critique. She said, "Thank you for your respect. And please pass my thoughts along to the others." As their carriage moved through the streets, pedestrians all moved their same way, tending alike, a flow going where V and Jeff were going. Birds in October shaping strange and beautiful patterns as they swirl against the sky, finding a common direction. The men walking alongside the carriage, the swing of their arms, their step, sway of shoulders, moved like a dance to entirely different music from the brass band's march. At the Capitol, V stood outside the carriage with an umbrella. The equestrian statue of Washington rose high above the proceedings. Very heraldic. Rampant. Dexter, all those conventions of honor. The bronze statue glowed wet and dark as obsidian above its pale stone base. Behind Washington, clouds churned patterns of gray and black, ominous or meaningless. Trying to decide which of the two prevailed, V kept looking up toward Washington and his hat of ancient vintage. Knowing many eyes turned her way, making judgments against her slightest gesture, she collapsed her umbrella and stepped back into the carriage. She had been here before. The band honked anthemic marching tunes from their bright horns, the flaring bells of trumpets and French horns, bright brass, and at the center a black vortex. Most people stood under umbrellas, a field of tight black satin domes, and hunched shoulders against the cold and wet. From behind the crowd, V's perspective, the arching ribs and scalloped canopies of umbrellas lapped each other into a cloud of descending bat wings. The platform, the stage, the scaffold, had been hammered together suddenly and raggedly from raw yellow pine, like a coffin at a July Mississippi funeral, but elevated in tone by bunting drooping lower moment by moment in the rain, the red and blue bands beginning to stain the white. V rested in the morphine and watched. A play, something medieval and full of morality, began unfolding on the stage before her. A story that ended bad. A tragedy. Raindrops on umbrellas beat faint Celt clan rhythms. Jeff climbed the steps to the stage, ascending to the scaffold, a willing victim throwing himself onto the wrong pyre, a volunteer. At the podium, he looked ashen, skeletal in the depth of his eye sockets and the prominence of cheekbones and hollowness of flesh below. But when he began talking, his voice swelled. He stood in the rain, speaking strong and clear. Projecting. It was a learned skill, a vibration in the vowels sounding completely natural but impossibly loud, a frequency riding over the hum of the audience. A matter of breath, muscle, volume of air pumped from the gray sacs of lungs across the vocal cords. Operatic, and yet just a matter of physics. From times she had sat on stage looking sideways at him against the light, V knew that spittle spewed with his effort. All his thin body leaning forward, muscles clenched, a fighting stance, ready to clash. Drops of spit and rain mixed and fell on the paper. V imagined the large words she had penned for him dissolving before his weak eyes. The blue ink on the exposed page becoming like a faint precious watercolor depicting the surface of a pond, a distant mountain range. Finally, Burton Harrison thought to step forward and hold an umbrella over him. V hardly noticed individual words, only the music of Jeff's speech. He believed in things. That much was clear from the rhythm and tone of his voice. The rise and fall of volume, the urgency. With those light implements, he meant to shove a hot iron rod up the backbone of an entire collapsing culture. He talked so much of God and the sanctity of property and the absolute rights of those who possess it this instant under a certain set of rules heretofore fluid but henceforth fixed. And no limitations allowed on the nature of property. Land, gold, silver, houses, people, livestock. A deep belief that your moment in time is the pinnacle. The only standard of judgment extending from the creation of light until the black apocalypse, that what you believe right now is eternal truth because you believe it so fervently. Those deep beliefs, so crucial at the moment, but none of them more permanent than a puff of air across a palm full of dry talcum. As the speech trudged on, nearing its halfway point, V kept having to suppress a cough, or a laugh, or a yawn, or a scream, or an expression of mourning 1 degree short of weeping. Untoward remarks flooded into her mind, funny and dreadful, such as the feeling that if she were writing a review, she would have to note that Jeff played his role with much less conviction than in her execution dream. She thought about how the flow of morphine through the human organism always carries with it so much clarity, so much objectivity. Jeff stood up there, minuscule and shouting, unreal in the distance, at the center of a parody of an inauguration. But not amusing, only terrifying. The wet black statue of Washington gleamed and expanded, a dark and indifferent god hiding behind his nose and strange hat, unwilling to pass judgment beyond his mere stern presence. V felt a sort of vibration, a rattle, and wondered for a moment if this was what an earthquake felt like in its early seconds. She touched the window frame of the carriage and it felt still. She leaned out the window and saw the horses standing calm, resting and waiting, half asleep with their ears relaxed. So the vibration, the rattle, the unease rose from inside. Still half out the window, she said to the driver, "Home, please." The driver twisted around, looked at her and said, "Right now." V abided within herself a space of time until the driver grew uncomfortable and needed to say something. "Ma'am, the mister's talk's not over. The president." V said, "Now, please. Now is the time to go home." The reins snapped and the carriage lurched forward and rattled across the cobbles. Eyes closed, V took 3 breaths through her mouth, and then 3 through her nose, and then tried out an idea, a hypothesis. "You've led an easy life, but everybody suffers. Judgment and punishment have hit with a light touch so far, the tap of a finger." By evening, the inaugural reception at the Gray House, V's mood had lifted. A party usually had that effect. She moved from group to group of drinkers and eaters, being witty and gracious and sharp. She stood at a height that most women and quite a few men had to look up to meet her eyes, and therefore resented her. Some in attendance found her too flirty with the men, and tracked her progress through the rooms by clusters of their delighted laughter. Next morning, the papers noted her early departure from the inauguration ceremony, but reported that as hostess for the reception, the First Lady performed with rare grace and unaffected dignity. V woke, covers over her head. She reached her hand to Jeff's side of the bed, but it had already gone cold between the sheets. He'd long since dressed and walked to his office, and probably skipped breakfast, which he knew he wasn't supposed to do. V thought drowsily how no one knows the inside of a marriage except the 2 people impounded together. Not family, not close friends, certainly not town gossips in the papers. Just the 2 bound in matrimony, and nobody can trust a word they say to anyone. Some are liars, who claim that after 40 years they've never had a crossword, or that they've never gone to bed mad. And then there are those couples exhausted and baggy-eyed and not bothering to hide their misery, just struggling to keep their heads above water, trying not to drown in the long aftermath of a bad match. or those happy and unequal marriages, like that of Mary Chestnut, where she emerged into her future husband's world at 13, so unquestionably lovely and delightful and quick of mind that she swept over him, though he was 21, son of a U.S. senator and later to become one himself. Like an incoming full moon tide, so powerful that he waited 4 long years to marry her, and delight in her entertainment every day until death parted them. But if the marriage is at all between equals, the two will certainly disagree about many things at any moment of the day during their time together. Not just details and facts, but the fundamental nature of the marriage, because the flow of power changes constantly, and the loser isn't always fully aware of defeat until much later. A moment from the previous night pulsed into her memory. Late, the dregs of the party, she wilted, tired, and unwary, and perhaps a little influenced by wine and leftover medication. A journalist, a new face among the press, stepped up and asked a question about her husband, something concerning the rash of harsh criticisms from Jeff's political enemies in Richmond, which landed vicious and endless with every morning's collection of newspapers. The journalist spoke with an English accent and seemed in his manner and appearance and clothing simultaneously polished and shabby and very bemused by our bloody war. A tray of champagne glasses eased by, and V swapped her empty for a full. What V ought to have done was ask what publication he represented, and then immediately say that his questions should be addressed to Burton Harrison, or perhaps to Judah Benjamin. But without thought or filter, she actually said, "What those miserable political animals are doing to that beautiful man. A man, let me be clear, I have wanted to kill many times for my own reasons, is disgusting and heartbreaking." Those words were true, her truth, but also dangerous. The society ladies of Richmond went about like beagles hunting rabbits, noses to the ground, yearning for the least whiff of damning gossip against her. And when they caught a scent, they went barking and yelping, breaking down and examining every element of her in order to come up with their own explanations for her darkness, which they twined with musty stories about Jeff's attraction to dark women. So V groaned into her pillow, knowing that a passing thought, or even a joke about killing her husband, could carry heavy consequences. How might the ladies fire that powerful ordinance once in control of it? Some would have called her treasonous. However, be honest. Name a marriage of equals without murderous thoughts now and then. Also, the damage from her comment wouldn't have been only among the ladies. Their men, military and political and wealthy and powerful, already thought V had too much influence. That Jeff's every action and decision bore her thumbprint, like a sloppily iced cake. As if his experience in Washington politics, and especially his legendary exploits in Mexico, were all nothing. One rumor constantly circulating was that V sat outside Jeff's office during meetings, eavesdropping. Occasionally true, of course, but only when Jeff knew he would want her opinion later, and asked her to sit near the open door and listen. Goes without saying that her sitting on the inner side of the door would have been impossible. But reconstructing those blurted thoughts about killing Jeff, she pictured the shabby, handsome writer. The instant the words fled her mouth, he lifted his pencil from his little notebook without jotting anything. He looked at her very seriously and for a length of time and then said, "My apologies for the question. I should speak to Mr. Benjamin. But thank you so much for chatting with me. I hope I shall always enjoy your trust." He kissed her hand and walked away. At that dazed moment of the party, she thought she had failed to charm him. Now, covers still over her head, she realized the gift he had given her in that simple lifting of pencil from page. Also, his eyes rising from the notebook to meet hers had been so personal, human to human.